This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Douglas Impuga, and here's what's coming up.
It's an unprecedented amount of attention and diplomacy going towards Africa, more than we've ever seen from a previous U.S. administration.
That's Cameron Hudson of the Center for Strategic International Studies on next week's three-nation trip to Africa by Vice President Kamala Harris, the fifth visit to the continent this year by high-ranking officials. Also, Egypt's president met with Russian officials to discuss a Russian-built nuclear power plant. The DRC has a new defense minister, and former Vice President Jean-Pierre Bemba. And today is World Tuberculosis Day. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. Vice President Kamala Harris will become the highest-ranking Biden administration official to visit the African continent when she begins a tour of Ghana, Tanzania, and Zambia next week. Her office says she will work on strengthening partnerships, security and economic prosperity, and analysts say her mere presence as the first female vice president who has ancestral ties to the continent is significant in itself. VOA's Anita Paul, who will be traveling with the vice president, reports from Washington.
After a wave of visits this year to the African continent by top U.S. officials, Vice President Kamala Harris steps up next. The White House says this builds on the administration's progress since last year's U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit, where President Joe Biden pledged to work to strengthen ties with the continent. Cameron Hudson is an analyst and consultant on African peace, security, and governance issues at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
She's the fifth senior-level U.S. official to go to Africa. She will have covered with her colleagues nearly a quarter of the countries in Africa with personal visits just in the last 3 months. So it's an unprecedented amount of attention and diplomacy going towards Africa, more than we've ever seen from a previous U.S. administration. So I think that's the significance of it.
And Harris, the highest-ranking elected woman in U.S. history, will also meet with the continent's only female head of state, Tanzanian President Samia Suluhu Hassan. The White House says Harris will speak with the elected leaders of all three countries about their commitment to democracy, a way, Hudson says, that Washington can distinguish itself.
There are also all countries that have a very substantial relationship with China on the trade front, the investment front, and now increasingly on the debt front. So, you know, this is a place where Washington can come and really advocate for the kind of democratic values and try to shore up those values and partnerships with countries that, like many other African countries, are, you know, working with a variety of powers.
Harris is expected to press African nations, many of which abstained from condemning Russia's invasion of Ukraine during United Nations vote, to acknowledge Russia's aggression. VOA asked National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby if the vice president would raise human rights concerns on her trip.
The vice president will, of course, raise human rights concerns everywhere she goes. That's part and parcel of American leadership around the world. We're not afraid. In fact, it's a sign of how much we care about other nations and partnerships that we are able and willing to have those kinds of conversations.
And democracy campaigners say they'd like to see her push democracy as well. David Carroll is director of the Democracy Program at the Carter Center, the foundation of former U.S. President Jimmy Carter.
It's important that the high-level attention is brought to this issue, and I think the fact that the vice president and others, other senior leaders, will be deeply involved in these events around the globe and in Zambia is very good, and it's important, to show that commitment and that sincerity and also the sincerity of purpose, and that's where, you know, it links back again to being able to be honest about where we need to address our own shortfalls.
And Harris wraps some family history into this visit. Her maternal grandfather, an Indian diplomat, worked with Zambia's first post-independence leader. Nearly 60 years later, his granddaughter, the most powerful woman to hold office in the U.S., and first South Asian and Black woman to rise to such heights, will meet with Zambia's president. Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
Now we are welcoming Professor Elliot Musosha of DeVry University School of Business in Columbus, Ohio, who is joining us live by phone to talk about Kamala Harris's trip. Welcome to the show, Professor.
Thank you.
What do you make of this high-profile visit to Africa by Vice President, the Vice President?
So this is, you know, a very, very, you know, big meeting, you know, a visit, and also the intention of the U.S. government had been shown before by another visit by Mrs. Harris. She has been in South Africa, and at this point in time, the U.S. government has sent at least 5 cabinet members to Africa to strengthen the relationship of the U.S. and Africa. Know, counted Chinese and Russians' activities in Africa as well, and to make a commitment to work together in a transparent way with Africa as a continent of opportunities, not previously held assumptions that Africa is a problem area. You know, so wherever there are conflicts, wherever there are problems, that's where opportunity is. And America has always been focusing on solving people's problems in a very transparent way. So Ms. Harris is going to Africa for the second time, visiting Ghana, Tanzania, and Zambia, which are some of the beacons of democracy. And as we know, democratically elected governments like the United States government, they are well known to work to solve people's problems. So Ms. Harris is going to Africa to talk about democracy and also address the youth in Africa. As we know, the majority of Africans are young people. You know, talking to business leaders, tech entrepreneurs, and digital sector leaders and groups that are advancing women in, you know, in economies. As we know, women are very much important. Much of the food that is eaten in the world is produced by women, and yet when it comes to, you know, economies, they are left behind. And that's what China and Russia don't look at all. So this is very much important and exciting times for Africa to go and learn from what America, you know, wishes and hopes and support Africa to become.
What do you read in her choice of countries? Of course, Ghana in the West, Tanzania in the East, Zambia in Southern Africa. What particular point does she is trying to make you think?
And of course, we know Ghana is very much important to Africa's independence. It was the first country to have its independence in 1957. It gave away its independence to African countries that were still colonized. So she's going there as a, you know, a symbol of African independence to Ghana. And, you know, from there, she's going to go to Tanzania as well, another stable democracy, you know, in East Africa. And previously, Secretary Blinken was in Ethiopia as well, a country where the African Union is headquartered. And from there, she's going to go to Southern Africa, to Zambia. That is a change of leadership in a very democratic and stable way, as well, as a sign that the model of American democracy works for the people.
And as far as Tanzania is concerned, some analysts have said, have pointed the uniqueness. Tanzania is led by a strong woman, a woman leader, and now Vice President Kamala Harris is top woman official in America. What a coincidence.
It's, you know, that's the reason why she's also going to meet with groups that advance women in economies, and it was not going to be a good trip for her as a woman not to visit a country led by a woman, to show to the world, to show to Africa, to show to girls and even boys that there is no need, there is no sense in leaving other people because of their gender or who they are in the development of humanity.
Thanks very much, Professor. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
In marking World TB Day, health officials warn the COVID-19 pandemic and multiple global crises are setting back years of progress in fighting tuberculosis and eventually ending this killer disease. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Tuberculosis, an ancient disease that some say goes back to biblical times, kills more people than any other infectious disease. The World Health Organization reports 1.6 million people globally died from TB in 2021, and an estimated 10.6 million people were newly infected. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says tuberculosis, a bacterial infection of the lungs, is a preventable, treatable, and curable disease. He says significant inroads have been made in battling it, noting that TB deaths have dropped by nearly 40% globally since 2000. However, he acknowledges this progress recently has stalled and even been reversed.
The COVID-19 pandemic and conflicts in many countries have severely disrupted services to prevent, detect, and treat TB. As a result, WHO last year reported an increase in TB deaths for the first time in more than a decade.
WHO reports the largest number of new TB cases, 46%, have occurred in the Southeast Asian region, followed by the African region with 23% and the Western Pacific with 18%. While the numbers remain high, WHO Regional Director for Africa, Matshidiso Moeti, says the continent has made progress in recent years in combating TB. For example, she notes deaths in the region have fallen by 26% between 2015 and 2021.
We do still face some challenges, notably delayed diagnosis and testing, since 40% of people living with TB did not know their diagnosis or the disease was not reported in 2021. Moreover, an estimated 1 million people are living with TB in the region yet to be detected.
In 2015, the United Nations set a target date of 2030 to end the global TB epidemic as part of the Sustainable Development Goals. In September, world leaders will meet in New York for the second high-level meeting on TB to invigorate this flagging process. WHO Chief Tedros says he believes the meeting could be a turning point in the fight against TB if leaders make real and lasting commitments to invest the financial resources needed to end it. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Democratic Republic of Congo has a new defense minister. Former Vice President Jean-Pierre Bemba, President Felix Tshisekedi announced the appointment yesterday ahead of an expected presidential election on December 20th. The International Criminal Court arrested Bemba, a former rebel leader, in 2008, for war crimes and crimes against humanity committed by his troops in the Central African Republic in 2002 through 2003. His conviction was reversed on appeal 10 years later, though he was found guilty of witness tampering during the trial. Reuters says the move was part of a cabinet reshuffle that was more extensive than expected. It included the appointment of President's former Chief of Staff, Vital Kamerhe, who was released from prison in December 2021 after being convicted for embezzlement. Four Kenyan members of parliament were charged yesterday with unlawful assembly for taking part in protests against the high cost of living and the government of President William Ruto. Reuters says the lawmakers include allies of opposition leader Raila Odinga in both houses of parliament. Odinga is demanding their release and also says the threat by Kenyan communications regulator to revoke the licenses of six TV stations that cover the demonstrations amounts to censorship. The Communications Authority of Kenya says the coverage could cause panic and threaten peace and cohesion in the country. Odinga has called for twice weekly protests against high costs of staples such as maize flour. He also accuses Ruto of cheating in last year's presidential election, an allegation denied by Ruto. Human rights groups, refugee organizations, activists and others gathered today in Johannesburg to discuss South Africa's failed asylum system, the state of migrants' documentation and legal options in the face of the cancellation of the Zimbabwe exemption permits. The discussion comes a few weeks before a court decides the challenge by several organizations to the decision by the Department of Home Affairs to terminate special permits issued to close to 180,000 Zimbabweans. The Helen Suzman Foundation, which is leading the court challenge, said it has a tight case. Thuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
Since 2008, South Africa has seen waves of anti-foreigner sentiment, which often has led to protests that at times turn into deadly riots. Such xenophobia has risen sharply as the country grapples with an unemployment rate of nearly 40%. Lawyers for Human Rights expressed concern at the rising number of immigration detentions, especially those involving asylum seekers. Eldona Muava works with Lawyers for Human Rights in South Africa.
We assist asylum seekers and refugees whose permits have expired, but they've not been able to renew them on time. We assist newcomers who have declared their intention to apply for asylum, but were arrested and detained anyway.
Tandega Chawe, also from Lawyers for Human Rights, told those gathered that it was wrong for citizens or officials to treat refugees and asylum seekers and immigrants as second-class citizens.
When you speak of issues affecting migrants, affecting asylum seekers, affecting refugees, we must remember that we're speaking of human beings that deserve the same dignity as South Africans.
Divashni Naidu, a researcher at the Helen Suzman Foundation, said the termination of the Zimbabwe special permits was one example where migrants have not been treated fairly, breaching the laws of justice.
One of those laws is that you have to have public participation with the group around which your decision involves.
However, Minister Motsoaledi has disputed this.
When we took this decision, we actually wrote to these people. So it can't be true that they don't know. We wrote to them. Personally, I signed a letter to each one of these 178,000 people involved.
Many delegates at the discussions argued that the decision to terminate the permits that has been postponed twice already has become a source of trauma for those who are not sure what the future holds. Thuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
You are listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Douglas Impoga in Washington. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah Sisi has met with high-ranking Russian officials to discuss a Russian-built nuclear plant, power plant, as well as grain supplies and food security. Reuters says the meeting included Russia's trade minister and a special envoy, President Vladimir Putin, and other topics included establishing a Russian industrial zone inside the Suez Canal's economic zone, among other investments. Mark Kaz, professor of government and politics at George Mason University, explained to VOA's senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shanawi the reasons behind Egypt's relationship with Russia while maintaining strategic cooperation with the U.S.
I think that the Egyptian government has made clear that it wants to be able to work with both the U.S. and with Russia, and of course with others, including China. They don't want to be dependent on just one country, and so working with the Russians, I think, advances their aims of increasing their leverage. I think the problem, though, that Egypt faces is that it's not clear to me at all that Russia can keep its commitments for completing this nuclear reactor while this war continues, much less building this industrial economic zone. But I think this it'll be very difficult for Russia to actually follow through on these.
As the West is imposing severe sanctions on Russia for its invasion of Ukraine, Russia is building Egypt's first nuclear power plant at Adaba, which is expected to begin operations in 2030. And Reuters says that Cairo is also depending more heavily on Russia for wheat imports since Moscow's war in Ukraine disrupted purchase from Kiev. What's your take on that?
Yes, well, certainly I think that the Egyptian dependence on Russian wheat imports is very serious. And I think that basically this is what gives the Russians a certain degree of leverage. Obviously, if the Russians don't renew this Black Sea export agreement, what they have with the Turks to allow Ukrainian grain out. This will affect the price of wheat overall, and Egypt will clearly pay the price. And I think that this is part of the problem that they face. I think for the Egyptians, what they would like is for this war to just end and the situation for grain exports to return to normal or as near normal as possible. But this isn't happening. And so, in fact, the wheat question in particular does increase Egyptian dependence on Russia. I'm not sure this is really beneficial for Egypt, though. As I indicated with regard to the nuclear reactor, supposedly to begin operations in 2030, you'll recall that it took the Russians forever to complete the reactor that they completed for the Iranians at Bushehr. I would very much expect that this project will also take much, much longer than anticipated.
Russia is seeking a naval base in Sudan, which seems to accept this request. How significant is this development for Russia's strategy in Africa?
Well, it seems that the Sudanese government are playing with the Russians. In other words, that there is an indication that they could have this, but that they seem to also be responding to American pressure for Russia not to have this naval base. It appears that the Egyptians are not very enthusiastic about Russia gaining a naval base in Sudan either. Egypt has traditionally viewed Sudan as a part of its sphere of interest. And so I think for the Egyptians, the Russian plan for a naval base in Sudan is not welcome. And I think that they'll be very happy if the Americans manage to help squash it, because basically, sort of the greater the military presence of Russia has in the countries around Egypt, then I think that the less freedom of maneuver that Egypt has in these countries.
That was Mark Kaz, professor of government and politics at George Mason University, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El Shanawi. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Douglas Impuga in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Mokbil Yebero, and Helen, our engineer tonight, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
March 24th is World Tuberculosis Day. The observance is an opportunity to shine a light on one of the world's oldest and deadliest diseases. This year's theme is Yes, We Can End TB. The date chosen for the observance, March 24th, commemorates Dr. Robert Koch's 1882 discovery of Mycobacterium tuberculosis, the bacterium that causes the disease. It was the first step on the journey towards reining in this merciless killer, which culminated in the discovery and eventual mass production of antibiotics in the middle of the 20th century. Tuberculosis, or TB, has plagued humans for thousands of years. Researchers found its sign in 6,000-year-old human skeletons and in the spines of 5,000-year-old Egyptian mummies. Indeed, Mycobacterium tuberculosis is believed to have evolved along with people, and it is still evolving. With the advent of the Industrial Revolution, the disease began to spread faster and more widely. As populations grew, people looking for employment began to migrate into cities. Overcrowded living conditions, lack of proper hygiene and nutrition, along with poor ventilation, created the perfect conditions for the spread of this contagious illness. By the late 19th century, tuberculosis was one of the most feared diseases, reaching epidemic levels in Europe and the Americas and causing one out of every seven deaths. Today, TB is still the world's deadliest infectious disease, causing the deaths of nearly 1.5 million people each year, most of them impoverished. It is no coincidence that the infection rate of TB within a population is one of the indicators of development. Those who lack access to good, nutritious food and to medical care are less likely to recover from TB or to avoid it altogether. With treatment, recovery rate stands at about 85%. Without treatment, TB kills half of its victims. Everyone should be able to lead a healthy, productive, and fulfilling life. That's our goal, said President Joe Biden at last year's seventh replenishment of the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. Let's finish this fight together. Now is the moment to accelerate our efforts to reduce health inequities and to address barriers to access, including gender and human rights barriers, to build a more inclusive healthcare systems, to leave no one behind, to end tuberculosis for good.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.